epilogue. My prediction regarding Crispus Humphreys, that given time he would see the absurdity of his position and perform a volte-face, did not have to wait long for its fulfilment. Within weeks of my return to England, he was making friendly overtures to me, overtures to which I did not immediately respond. Early in the 1970s, I was once again lecturing at the Buddhist Society's premises in Eccleston Square under his chairmanship. During the last 5 or 6 years of his life, Toby and I met fairly regularly, and he assured me on more than one occasion that he'd always been my best friend. In his autobiography, Both Sides of the Circle, published in 1978, he spoke in highly complimentary terms about me and about the Western Buddhist Order, to which, he said, he gave his full support. Morris and Ruth Walsh I saw only once more. Along with 6 or 7 other monks, I had been invited to the Vietnamese embassy for a meal. When Morris and Ruth entered the room and saw me chatting with the monks, they were extremely confused and embarrassed and at once retreated. Ruth died not many years later, and Morris soon remarried. After his retirement, he spent the rest of his long life producing a scholarly new translation of the Digha Nikaya and campaigning against me and the FWBO. The monk who conducted his funeral service humorously remarked that he knew he was dead because when he bent over him and whispered Sangharakshita in his ear, he did not react. Goulstone and Marcus I neither saw nor heard of again. Alf Weil and Mike Hookham continued to tread the path of Tibetan Buddhism, though under the direction of another guru, Trungpa having departed for the greener pastures of the United States, while Jack Ireland pressed on with his Pali studies, eventually producing a useful new translation of the Udana and Itivutaka. Anandabodhi travelled widely, transformed himself first into Nyingyal Rinpoche and then into Star One, and developed his own holistic cleaning method of meditation. Mangalo stayed in England and became a Church of England clergyman. Both Ratanasara and Vichitta followed Trungpa's example and betook themselves to the United States, where the latter returned to lay life and married. Virya was not long at the Hampstead Vihara. Shortly before my return to England, he left for Vietnam, Tien Chau having arranged for him to study at the Van Han University under my old friend Thich Minh Chau. Later, he settled in Japan and married a Japanese woman. Tien Chau himself moved to Paris, where I stayed with him in 1970, and where he arranged for me to give a few lectures, my first on the continent. Activities at the Vihara having virtually ceased, Francoise soon found herself out of a job and went to work at John Watkins, the famous Oriental bookshop just off Charing Cross Road. John Hipkin, Mike Rogers, Emil and Sarah Boyne, and Mike Ricketts were among the 12 founding members of the Western Buddhist Order, all of whom I ordained at Centre House on Sunday, the 7th of April, 1968, after I had given them their private ordinations and their new names at the Tri Ratna Meditation and Shrine Room in the course of the previous 10 days. And what of Terry de la Mer? In August 1967, he and I moved into a bigger flat on the third floor of an old terraced house at the lower end of Highgate, West Hill. He had continued to be very depressed, and even before we moved, had started seeing Dr. David Cooper, the psychiatrist at whose Villa 21 he had undergone his ether abreaction, or seen the pure white light, 4 years earlier. Soon he was seeing him twice a week, but neither his sessions with Cooper nor the antidepressants he was now taking did him much good, and in the course of the next few months his condition grew steadily worse. My diary for these months is full of such entries as Terry very low all day, Terry extremely low again, collapsed on the stairs, Terry very low, had quite a terrible hour. By the end of the year, he was talking of suicide, and in January told me he had reached rock bottom. During this period, I was busy taking meditation classes at Sakura, giving lectures in various public halls, and visiting the provincial Buddhist groups, which did not close their doors to me, despite Walsh's efforts to persuade them to do so. I was thus in the unenviable position of having to live in, or at least commute between, two very different worlds, and I often felt the strain. This was particularly the case after Terry started talking of suicide, as I took such talk seriously. More than once, having taken the meditation classes at Sakura that evening, I walked up the hill from the bus stop, not knowing whether, on my arrival at the flat, I would find Terry alive or dead. The strain was exacerbated by the fact that I was unable to share my concern for Terry with any of our friends, as he was adamant that no one should know he was a victim of depression. Indeed, he put on such a good front whenever he drove me to Sakura or attended my lectures, that it was a long time before Emil, Sarah and the rest suspected that there was anything wrong. The only person with whom I was able to discuss Terry's condition was Cooper, whom I met twice. I formed an unfavourable impression of him. He was to die of chronic alcoholism, and moreover found his therapeutic commonplaces unhelpful. It was about this time that Terry wrote his parents a letter in which he told them, as tactfully as he could, that his childhood had not been a happy one, a claim to which they responded with hurt and incredulity. They were in any case quite worried about him already, the more especially as they had not seen him for nearly a year and had no idea what he was doing. Terry therefore asked me to go and see them and assure them that he had not gone mad, as they seemed to think. His father was a tall, powerfully built man who evidently had a temper, while his mother, no less obviously, was a chronic depressive. Both parents, I soon found, were convinced that the study of philosophy had affected their son's brain, and that if he would only give it up and go back to his job in advertising, all would be well. "We can understand him wanting a change from work sometimes," his mother told me, "but he can always come and help his dad in the greenhouse on a Saturday afternoon." Terry must have gone in fear of his father, I thought, and have sucked in depression with his mother's milk. When, therefore, he started going to pottery classes and made a black pottery head with round staring eyes and a hole of a mouth lined with jagged teeth, I was not surprised to learn that he proposed to call the hideous object Mother, or Woman, or perhaps Death. Unfortunately, I stopped keeping a diary after the 15th of April 1968, so that for the last year of Terry's life, I have no written record but only memories. He was now living with Mafalda, a gentle, dark-haired Portuguese divorcee who had been attending my meditation classes and lectures. In January 1968, he had taken a room in a friend's house at Chalk Farm, but communal living proved uncongenial to him, and after a few months he had moved into Mafalda's flat in Islington. He came to see me almost every day. Some days he came twice, and sometimes he brought Mafalda with him. He continued to be deeply depressed, though he hid it from the world, even from Mafalda. And when we were alone together, he talked with ever-increasing desperation of suicide. There was only one alternative, he declared, that he should be enabled to re-enter the pure white light and in this way transcend the pain of existence, which had become unbearable. With this end in view, he asked Cooper to give him LSD. He had previously given him marijuana to no effect. Cooper agreed, but insisted that he took it under medical supervision. Terry therefore found himself taking the drug not at Mafalda's flat in her company, as he had wanted, but in the office of a white-coated woman doctor, whose telephone kept ringing and who spent most of her time answering it. The result was that he experienced nothing. This finally convinced him that he could hope to see the pure white light only at the moment of death, and that he had no choice, therefore, but to commit suicide. in April came the FWO's Easter retreat, which I led and which Terry and Mafalda also attended. John Hipkin and our other friends were shocked to see how depressed and ill Terry looked, for by this time he had given up trying to conceal his condition. The retreat ended on Sunday the 13th of April, and after the concluding puja and meditation, Terry, Mafalda and I left for London in a little bus, Mafalda and I sitting beside Terry in the front seat. Halfway through the journey, Terry suddenly declared that he felt like driving at top speed into the nearest brick wall and killing all three of us. And for a few minutes it seemed that he might actually do this. After dropping me at Highgate West Hill, he drove on to Islington with Mafalda. At 10 o'clock the next morning, I received a visit from two uniformed police officers. I knew at once what this meant. Terry had died 2 hours earlier, they informed me. He had died at Kentish Town Underground Station, having apparently thrown himself under an approaching train, and my address had been found on his body. In response to their inquiries, I told them that my friend had left 9 months ago and gave them his parents' address as well as Mafalda's. When the officers had gone, I noticed that on my desk there was a small pile of letters that had not been there the night before. Terry had come very early in the morning, while I was asleep, and left them. Two of the letters were for me. "I must be brief, for I am too upset," the first letter began. "My greatest fear is that I shall live after this event. If this should happen, please make something possible. But I hope my remarks are superfluous." His biggest regret, Terry went on to say, was that he never lived to bring all his energy and love, which he believed to have been quite considerable, into being. He also asked me to look after Mafalda as best I could. He expressed his conviction that we could have worked miracles together on this earth, and maybe would do so another day, and reflected on the paradoxical split in his nature, which had, he believed, torn him apart. He concluded, "We will always be together. What happiness. Yours ever, T." The second letter was much shorter and dealt with various practical matters. A few hours later, Terry's parents came to see me. They came straight from the mortuary and reported that Terry had a slight bruise on one side of his head, but looked peaceful. I gave them the letter he had left for them. In it, he asks that he should be given a Buddhist funeral, that he should be cremated, and that I should be invited to conduct the funeral. He also asks that I should be given £1,000 out of his estate, and Mafalda £500. His father's face darkened as he read the letter. It was not a legally valid will, he told me, and he proposed to ignore it. Terry would be given a Christian funeral and be buried in the local cemetery, so that his mother could visit the grave and change the flowers every Saturday afternoon after doing her shopping. The next day they came again. This time it was to collect Terry's suits. There were 3 or 4 of them, and his mother insisted on my pinning sheets of newspaper round each one. "What would the neighbours think," she asked, "if they were to see us coming out of the house carrying men's suits?" For 2.5 days after Terry's death, I heard him calling me and felt him pulling, I subsequently wrote in a notebook. Could not bear the thought of his suffering under the wheels of the underground train alone. Strong wish to follow. Kept seeing him standing on the edge of the platform, waiting. Sense of waste. Perhaps it was because of my wish to follow Terry that at some point during those 2.5 days I went to Kentish Town Underground Station, stood on the edge of the platform as Terry had done, and tried to imagine what it had been like for him as he waited for the train. I also attempted to describe Terry's last hours in a poem. The poem was entitled "For the Record" and was addressed to him. You wrote 4 letters, one to your parents, one to the girl who looked after you, one to your accountant, and one to your best friend, me. Sealed them neatly. You wrote out 2 cheques in settlement of small debts. walked around here and there, came in, went out two or three times, returned my typewriter. It was early morning. I was in bed, asleep, did not hear you. Felt a little uneasy, perhaps, for a minute or two. Parked your bus down at Kentish Town in front of an old brick wall where it would not be in anybody's way, after drawing the faded red curtains. Bought a ticket to somewhere, anywhere. Rode down the escalator. Stood, heron hunched, in your old black duffel coat, hands thrust deep in pockets, brooding, thinking, meditating. Watched, waited, anticipated, and when the train came, heavily lumbering along the platform, slowly gliding along the smooth, shining rails, suddenly threw yourself under, and in a moment found what you had been seeking all your life. Under the heading Obituary, FWBO Newsletter 5 carried the following report. It is with very deep regret that we record the death of Terry Delamere on Monday the 14th of April. He was born in 1934 and gave up a successful career in advertising 3 years ago to devote himself fully to the study of philosophy, religion and psychology. In October 1966, he accompanied the venerable Stavira Sangharakshita to India, where he took the remarkable series of colour slides entitled Buddhism in India, which has given pleasure to so many of our friends. On Monday the 21st of April, a memorial service was held at 52 Knoll Road, Islington, the residence of Mrs. Mafalda Reyes. The simple but moving ceremony was conducted by the Venerable Sangharakshita and was attended by many friends who had not only known Terry but loved him for his great qualities of head and heart. But though I missed Terry and wept every day for 6 months, what he had called this event was not an unrelieved tragedy. The day after his death I took the classes at Sakura as usual. While meditating, I heard these words. Pain shall be transmuted into joy, suffering into ecstasy, when to the eternal life of Buddhahood we all awake. The End of Moving Against the Stream, The Birth of a New Buddhist Movement, by Sangharakshita. Spoken by Subhadra.